The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And let's not be too shocked about the talk of who might be the next Secretary of State in the Trump administration before we get all full of anxiety about that. Back in the 1930s, U.S. foreign policy was all about oil. And it was Standard Oil, the forerunner of today's Exxon, that opened Saudi Arabia.
Such decisions are not made lightly. And many an hour of study and debate had occupied many men before the company sent the late Lloyd Hamilton, one of the great figures of Middle Eastern oil, as emissary to Arabia.
With talk of a former ExxonMobil CEO, Rex Tillerson, as Secretary of State, could we be returning to those oil policy-driven days? And is Russia, the Saudi Arabia of today, much in need of U.S. technology to get its oil reserves out of the ground, as the Saudis needed the U.S. and needed Standard Oil back in the 1930s? A Trump business deal foreign policy looks to Russia as a possible friend and looks to China in a new confrontational way. The president-elect has once again suggested that he might not be bound by the one China policy negotiated by Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger. Trump and Taiwan are shaking things up in Beijing. We'll talk about that in a moment. But this weekend, new information surfaced about Russia intervening in the U.S. presidential election. An unnamed high-level source said the CIA conducted an internal secret assessment and determined that Russian hackers had some impact on rigging the election in favor of Donald Trump. Trump and his team are denouncing the news. On Sunday, a bipartisan group of four senators came forward and asked for a congressional investigation into the alleged cyber attacks. Senators Lindsey Graham, John McCain, Jack Reed, and Charles Schumer. Fred Burton is a former counterterrorism agent with the U.S. State Department and the vice president of intelligence with the geopolitical strategy firm Stratfor. He says such revelations shouldn't come as a complete surprise.
Well, I think the Cold War never ended, which unfortunately a lot of people don't want to admit. And in essence, these kinds of actions take place all the time. And from a historical perspective, if you go back to the 60s and the 70s, the Russian KGB was very active in supporting a tremendous amount of domestic terrorist organizations and, in essence, just trying to destabilize the U.S. government. So this arena with cyber, in essence, is the new frontier when it comes to Cold War actions. And the actors in this are just all across the map.
But if it's, you know, been going on for so long, how do we distinguish these particular actors from what's happened in the past? And is there any link to Donald Trump himself?
Again, I think it's hard to say. When you look at this from a forensic perspective, the rub is this. Our National Security Agency, the NSA, is no doubt the best in the world in this sphere. And in order to admit what you know at times, you could be compromising very sensitive sources and methods. So in essence, to me, the leak surrounding this is something that also needs to be looked at because of the nature of this kind of space that the intelligence community operates in.
The CIA source claims that hacking had some impact on rigging the election in favor of Donald Trump. I don't quite understand what that means. Is it decisive? Is it just, I mean, what would be the smoking gun here?
The smoking gun, John, would be, I think, in that context, would be the specific emails that were outed on WikiLeaks, for example, focused on the Democratic National Committee. And when you look at that, again, you get into the sources and methods of how do we know that, in fact, that originated from, in this case, if the allegation is correct, the Russians. My only caution in this sphere is that, again, there's so many different cutouts and actors engaged in this cyberspace that I'm not so sure that the truth will ever be known.
Well, I know you're being careful here, and I appreciate that. But are the Russians in any special position to carry out this kind of a hack, or could anyone paying attention to the election have done the same sort of thing?
There's several different actors, to include the Russians, that are quite good in the cyberspace, but so are the Iranians, so are groups such as Hezbollah, such is the intelligence services of the Chinese, specifically the People's Liberation Army. So there's there, at a state sponsor perspective, those players. And then at the cutout level, it could be anything from Ukrainian activists that broke in and handed the information over to the Russians that passed it to Wiki. So this is a very, very complicated mess at times, trying to figure out exactly who was engaged in this kind of activity.
Would it surprise you at all if Putin had said, "I love this guy Trump, do whatever you need to do to get him elected," and that that order was sent out in Moscow, and that what we're seeing is evidence that somebody took him up on it?
That certainly wouldn't surprise me, John. In essence, when you look at the long history of Russia and the KGB and their antics inside the United States going back to the 60s and the 70s, look, this is what nation states do at times from a covert action capacity. I would be very cautious until we have more digital fingerprints that, if and ever these are released, to nail down exactly who the actors were. There's so many different layers in this space, John.
But you're not prepared to say that Russia is not in the top five suspects here, right?
I certainly would put them within the top tier of potential actors that who have done this. But there's so many different front companies and digital hackers in this space that are contract jobs. There's people that steal these kinds of emails and sell them to nation state services. So who did it? That's the question.
Fred Burton is vice president of intelligence for Stratfor, the global intelligence company. He spoke with us from Austin, Texas. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you, John, for having me.
So a possible clear preference on the part of Russia's Vladimir Putin for Donald Trump. Is that bluster and spin, or could it have been decisive on November 8th? Whatever the truth on the hacking front, there may be a pattern emerging in the way Donald Trump is reacting and signaling to the world. A warm approach to Vladimir Putin, who has been under sanctions for much of the Obama second term because of the unrest in Ukraine. Talk of a two-China policy, which has produced an immediate outraged reaction from Beijing. David Sanger from The New York Times says there are hints of a major shift in U.S. policy with the appointment of Rex Tillerson, former Exxon CEO, to be Secretary of State, but it could also just be a typical Trump-style shakeup.
Certainly, Rex Tillerson as a choice for Secretary of State would fit into one pattern that I think President-elect Trump really appreciates. He's got a deep relationship with a lot of world leaders, including some of the world's nastiest dictators. That's because nasty dictators frequently sit on top of large reserves of oil. It's just the way geography and geopolitics have intertwined. The second thing is he knows how to negotiate with them. I think the problem that you're going to run into, and the one that will result into so much scrutiny of Mr. Tillerson when he gets to the Senate, is the following. First of all, he has frequently argued against sanctions against, for example, Russia for its activities in Ukraine on the basis that there is a lot of collateral damage from those sanctions. The collateral damage is ExxonMobil. Obviously, they haven't been able to go reap the rewards of the deals that they have struck for exploration in Russia. So the question is, as Secretary of State, if he moved away from those sanctions, would it appear that he was serving American interests or serving ExxonMobil's? And he's got to answer that question. I think second problem is that when you go in to negotiate as the head of a large oil company, you are negotiating a single transaction usually, maybe a broader relationship, but that transaction may or may not be in national interests. And the question is he able to sort of flip the switch and talk about American national interests and negotiate on that behalf, even if it is hurtful to American business?
From Tillerson's perspective, and possibly Trump's perspective, though, is there an argument, you know, maybe a fallacious argument, but still an argument for uniting Russia and the United States, two of the biggest oil producers, to confront China? And you have Donald Trump talking about this two China policy, which drives the Chinese crazy. Is it conceivable that he's viewing a kind of Russia U.S. bipolar world in some, you know, new Cold War?
It's possible. And you, in fact, saw an effort to split Russia and China back in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations. In fact, late in the Kennedy administration, just before the president's assassination, there was even a discussion that took place between Washington and Moscow about whether they ought to jointly attack a Chinese nuclear site where the Chinese ultimately ended up testing their first nuclear weapons. In this case, though, China and Russia pose completely different kinds of foreign policy. In China, you have a rising power trying to displace a status quo power in the United States, but one that is basically economically dynamic and has a lot of future economic relationship with the U.S. In Russia's case, you have a declining, desperate economic power that is not been able to diversify its economy, not been able to do what the Chinese have. And I think you'd have to ask yourself the question, is that really the one of those two superpowers you want to go sign up with?
How long will China go along with this discussion of two Chinas from President-elect Trump? I mean, is it something that is actually a negotiating position, that it so worries the Chinese that there may be actually something to be gained by talking about Taiwan in this way? Or is it just a panic button for the Chinese?
The Chinese have a couple of neuralgic issues, and obviously Taiwan is one of them. Tibet is another. These go to territorial sovereignty kind of issues. There have been other American presidents who have edged out in this direction. Ronald Reagan invited the Taiwanese to come to his inauguration. Perhaps he'll see the same thing here. Who knows? But if President-elect Trump decided to fundamentally change the relationship with China that was negotiated by Nixon and Kissinger so many years ago, I think that the question would be, who does that put in the better negotiating position, the Chinese or the United States? And if you were going to go do it, then I think you'd want to go lay the groundwork with all of our Asian allies, who would be as shocked by this change as they were shocked by the Nixon opening to China. And you want to make sure that you do that diplomacy just right and in the right sequence. We haven't seen that so far.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for our partner, the New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Great to be with you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
A return to the Cold War, that's the talk from the Trump transition in foreign policy. But on the domestic front, we may also be hearing signs of a back to the 1980s confrontation over Medicare. Democrats have already signaled that cuts or changes to Medicare are fighting words. President-elect Trump said during the campaign he would not cut Medicare. However, his nominee for Secretary of Health and Human Services, Representative Tom Price, has expressed interest in privatizing Medicare and creating a voucher-type program. The idea is to increase competition among suppliers and give beneficiaries more freedom to choose the care they want. But critics say such changes would lower coverage and could change rules for consumers in the middle of treatment. Mary Agnes Carey, partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News, says talk of Obamacare repeal and changes in Medicare put all of healthcare into play.
What you might see is the government shifting from a defined benefit where a lot of things are covered to a defined contribution, and then private plans get in there and bid for business. So you would have the traditional Medicare, which about two-thirds of beneficiaries are enrolled in, and now you've got about a third of beneficiaries in private plans. So as that marketplace continues, you could see the government shifting the way they pay for Medicare benefits. And so then it would be up to how do you define what the plans cover? How much does that payment increase every year? What does it cover? What does it not cover? Who pays more? Who pays less? There are a lot of questions to shake out. It's a fairly complicated calculation.
How much would consumers be involved in those difficult questions? I mean, can you see someone who's being treated by an oncologist suddenly being whipsawed around about treatments that were covered once and all of a sudden are being questioned, that sort of thing?
That's a very fair question to ask, because the traditional fee-for-service Medicare, again, two-thirds of beneficiaries are in that, that tends to have a wider network. And we have seen in the past, sometimes if a Medicare beneficiary is currently in a private insurance plan and then the network begins to narrow, perhaps some of the benefits begin to change, they shift back to traditional fee-for-service. So you could have the exact example you lay out, someone who's in the middle of chemotherapy, and all of a sudden maybe their oncologist isn't on the plan anymore and they need to shop around and find a plan that does cover that oncologist.
So in some sense, the fear rhetoric on the part of Democrats is not completely unwarranted. I mean, this kind of change in the middle of the stream would be fairly scary for a lot of consumers.
It could. It all depends how it's defined, right? How much money is allocated? What requirements are placed on the insurers? A key thing is how much does that contribution grow? As we know, healthcare inflation, healthcare prices rise a lot faster than the other prices that inflation is calculated on. So if that contribution doesn't keep pace with healthcare inflation, it could mean that it buys less down the road.
And they're talking about capping the contributions, capping the cost of Medicare, that being the overall mission of this entire policy. If that's the case, you would expect that contribution would be limited.
It would be, and if you cap it, you would save federal dollars, right? You would save what the federal government is spending. But the point you alluded to earlier, you're going to have a huge political fight on your hands. Beneficiaries, as we know, Medicare beneficiaries, they're very powerful. They mobilize. They vote. Democrats are already saying that they will stand firm against any changes to Medicare. And it's entirely unclear if Republicans will even go down this road. You've got House Republicans who've voted for this approach before. But we already see Senate Republicans, some in the leadership of major committees, saying, you know, let's not bite off more than we could chew. Let's slow down a little bit. So everyone is sensitive to the political calculation here.
You mentioned that there is a relationship or an interactivity between the private sector insurance market and some Medicare consumers. And right now, some of them are covered under their private plans, but they also get supplementary coverage from Medicare. And I'm just wondering if the private sector is even interested in getting involved in this whole thing. As this changes, could you expect that the private sector would actually help to make this less of a bumpy transition? Or would they be inclined to view this whole thing as like just run as you know, run screaming as fast as you can away from it?
Sure. It all depends on what the rules of the road are. They'll look at how much money they're going to get. They'll look at what sort of rules are placed on them in the sense of what benefits they have to cover, which ones they can skip, what kinds of flexibility and approaches can they have in design on this benefit. And you've got to remember, the number of current beneficiaries in these private plans is already a third. That's a fairly large growth in the last decade. So some people, when they get into Medicare, they've already had private insurance at a job. They want to continue with that private insurance company. So I think insurers definitely see a market here, and it has been pretty lucrative for them in Medicare. The key will be going forward, if this approach is taken, what are the rules? Where's the money? What's the flexibility? How can they design their packages?
It seems to me that what you've got is, with the talk of repealing Obamacare and the talk of changing Medicare, you really are talking about a system that is evolving, where Medicare is going to look more like Obamacare and Obamacare is going to look more like Medicare, that's where we're headed.
Well, it's really very much up in the air, but I can kind of see where you're coming from, because if you repeal the Affordable Care Act, the question will be, what do you replace it with, right? The ACA relied on private insurers to get in there and offer benefits. And now if this whole debate on Medicare shifts, there'll be an even greater role for the private sector. So there are a lot of balls up in the air and a lot of questions to be asked, but I think you can't ever forget about the political power on both of these, for example, right? If the Republicans repeal the Affordable Care Act, what are they going to replace it with and when are they going to do it? And same thing on Medicare. If you change the dynamics there, there's just a lot of dangerous territory to be trod. And so I think people are going to go very, very carefully, especially on the Republican side on these.
Mary Agnes Carey is partnerships editor and senior correspondent for Kaiser Health News. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
Among the least popular players in healthcare is so-called Big Pharma. Drug companies produce what they want, charge what they want, and the market has traditionally had to accept it. The business model? Get as much of your research subsidized by grants and publicly supported national laboratories, then patent an FDA-approved drug and reap the profits until the patent runs out. Public awareness has disrupted this formula. The Mylan Corporation, makers of the life-saving EpiPen, announced late last week they were cutting 3,000 jobs, nearly 10% of the workforce, to deal with falling stocks after coming under investigation for inflating the cost of the drug from about $100 to more than $600 in recent years, as the timeline on their exclusive patent is set to expire. Clyde Haberman in this week's Retro Report says this whole approach to drug development was set in motion by polio vaccine developer Jonas Salk, who was, it turns out, fiercely opposed to patents.
So Salk was interviewed in 1955 when his vaccine came out and was asked who owns the patent. And Jonas Salk said, well, the people, I would say. There is no patent. And then he paused and he said with a laugh, how could you patent the sun?
The transition that takes place from this sort of people's notion of medicine to a business that needs to be sustained by profit is described here by Lori Riley, who's an executive vice president for policy and research at the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. This is exactly what you expect, they would say.
I think it's important to look at the advancements that we've gotten and ask whether or not those advancements would have occurred without a for-profit industry.
That's the drug company's argument, that hundreds of millions, even billions, go into research, go into development, go into often failed or disappointing research. So the high prices for certain drugs have to pay for all of that. The counter argument to them on that, of course, would be, you know, you don't spend quite as much on R&D as you think. Mm-hmm. They spend a tremendous amount of money on advertising, sometimes twice as much as they do on research and development.
Tell me the story of Barbara Heiser, because there is a situation where if you pay for the drug, it literally financially is going to kill you.
Yeah. She found the drugs that she needed for her cancer were skyrocketing. And it was a question of, do I choose my home and food or drugs?
So I called to renew my drugs, and the operator said, I'm going to charge your credit card $5,000. And I said, what? At that time, I said to my husband, I said, you know, I feel like I'm being faced with the choice of either keep our house and keep the lifestyle that we have or stay on Gleevec. We couldn't do both.
What she had was something known as CML, chronic myeloid leukemia. It's a blood cancer. And Gleevec is one of those pills that qualifies as a miracle drug. Truly, it attacks specifically the cancer. It doesn't poison, you know, every cell in the body as so many forms of chemotherapy do. So, yeah, this is essential for somebody like Ms. Heiser. And a regimen will exceed at least $100,000 a year. And there are many, many examples like this.
Are there ways in which the patents of medicines can actually be seen as part of the public trust? Because sometimes medicines are developed with taxpayer funds at universities, even though they end up being patented.
This has been controversial. There was a bill in 1980 that's known as the Bayh-Dole Bill. And there is within the provision of the Bayh-Dole Act, is called march-in rights. It means the government can march in and take the patent away from the company or give it to other companies as well as the original company if it's felt that what the prices being set are unreasonable. There have been at least a half a dozen, maybe even a dozen petitions to have the government, usually through the National Institutes of Health, march in and do something about the high prices. The government has yet to act on it. Doctors have protested the high price of Gleevec, for example, invoking this question of morality and asking, when does legitimate profit-making turn into profiteering?
Back to the old argument, can you patent the sun? What's public? What's private? This week's Retro Report looks at all of that. Clyde Haberman is New York Times contributing writer. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Is Turkey in the driver's seat right now in negotiations with Europe and the United States? The U.S. has condemned widespread purges of civil society, purges that in theory might affect Turkey's status as a NATO member. It has already taken Turkey's application to be in the EU off the table for now. Turkey is leery of U.S. support for Kurdish groups, though, especially as a blast rocked Istanbul that killed dozens this weekend was allegedly carried out by a Kurdish militant group. The EU is meeting this week to discuss how it will approach the Turkish situation, a fine line for the EU, which counts on Turkey to close its borders to the hundreds of thousands of migrants and refugees attempting to cross its vast southern border. President Obama last week waived prohibitions of arms sales to a Turkish enemy, the Syrian Kurds. Mahir Zainalov is a columnist with Al Arabiya and a contributor to the Huffington Post.
We really don't know that what Turkey's goals are in northern Iraq, in Syria. Turkey already invaded Syria to make sure that the two separate Kurdish cantons do not unify there. Turkey deserves plaudits to seal its border off ISIS. He's very unpredictable. He's very impulsive in his behaviors. And we really don't know that what Turkey's goals are in northern Iraq, in Syria. Turkey already invaded Syria to make sure that the two separate Kurdish cantons do not unify there. Turkey deserves plaudits to seal its border off ISIS. But again, they are driving to a city called Elbab, and the United States and Russia do not really want Turkey to go up there because it will further complicate the situation. And critics say that Turkey is actually fighting against a Kurdish group called YPG rather than ISIS there. And the United States doesn't really know how to deal with Turkey. And the reason why Erdogan and his inner circle have been celebrating the victory of Donald Trump is because it's an indication how relations were too bad with the Obama administration. And Turkey repeatedly called on Washington to avoid arming and supporting the Kurdish militants in northern Syria. And the United States turned a blind eye to Turkey's demands. And Turkey views the YPG, Syrian Kurdish militants there, as a brethren to the PKK, which is an insurgent group, which struck at the heart of Istanbul just 2 days ago and killed 44 people.
It appears, though, that the U.S. is committed to some Kurdish national entity being formed somewhere, whether in Iraq or Syria. Can Turkey do anything about that?
Well, I don't know how Turkey can prevent an independent Kurdistan to take form in the near future. We already have Iraq and Kurdistan, which is a de facto independent, but they really depend on Turkey to export their oil and energy resources to Israel and to European countries. So it's important that Turkey is on board if any Kurdish state emerges.
So this explains why Turkey seems to feel as though it holds all the cards. Turkey controls pretty much all the levers of refugees. And in a sense, do you think it's holding the EU hostage on this question of refugees?
Oh, you're absolutely right. When you look at it, Turkey, we have more than 125,000 people have been dismissed, purged, or sacked. More than 90,000 people have been detained since the failed coup attempt on July 15, and half of them were arrested pending trial. The mass purge, the scale of the purge is unprecedented. It's something that the world has not seen in decades. But the problem is Turkey is a very important country in terms of geopolitics. It's a transit country for refugees into Europe. And Turkey exactly knows that if it opened the gates and when the refugees flood in the European capitals, it will fuel xenophobic races and it will fuel the far-right parties to rise and take over governments in European capitals as we have elections next year in Italy, in France, and with all the situation about Brexit, Turkey exactly knows that the migrant deal is there to stay because Turkey is interested in getting a cash from European Union, which they promised to give 3 billion euros, and Turkey exactly needs this cash at this point as there's a financial meltdown in Turkey. And of course, the European Union needs Turkey to make sure that the migrant deal is there. I can't even imagine that the European Union or the United States can impose crippling economic sanctions on Turkey, which is a NATO member, at the time when there's problems in Syria, Iraq, and problems with Russia.
Mahir Zainulov is a columnist with Al Arabiya and a contributor to the Huffington Post. He spoke with us from Washington, D.C. Mahir, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You know, I never get emotional, but to have my name called and sitting next to great players, I'm overwhelmed right now.
Louisville's Lamar Jackson surprised no one in taking the Heisman Trophy over the weekend. The trophy traditionally rewards the best college football player, and it has mostly gone to team-leading quarterbacks down through the years, with few exceptions. Those quarterbacks have nearly all been white. Jackson is the sixth black quarterback to win the Heisman, and in 2016, we are a long way from the pioneer play callers, Doug Williams, Joe Gilliam, and Parnell Dickinson, among others. It was not a pleasant time for the first black quarterbacks in the NFL to challenge the all-white Bart Starr, Roger Staubach, and Joe Montana image. It took Warren Moon in 1984 to break enough records with the Houston Oilers to pave the way. Although Philadelphia's Donovan McNabb was plagued by charges that his performance was less important than his race, Rush Limbaugh got fired as a TV commentator in 2003 for suggesting that McNabb was being coddled by some NFL affirmative action policy. Cam Newton, who led the Carolina Panthers into the Super Bowl last February, said, "I'm an African American. That may scare a lot of people because they haven't seen nothing they can compare me to." Newton has also said NFL officials have not been making calls to protect him during games because he is black. William C. Roden, a writer-at-large for ESPN's The Undefeated, wrote the book Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. Roden says, whatever the record books say, it has been uniquely hard for African-American quarterbacks to find success in the NFL.
The quarterback position is in football, I think, defines everything that black men are not supposed to be. Tough, grace under pressure, intelligent, smart on their feet.
Leader in the locker room.
Positive trait you can mention is what black men and black people are not supposed to be. And it's sort of, it all coalesces at this one position in our great national pastime, football. The quarterback always has the ball. All eyes are on the quarterback. If you look at the National Football League, almost every other position, wide receivers, skill positions, almost the entire defense and the secondary and defensive backs, now almost are almost African-American men. I mean, almost to the point of the starting lineups at any given time be almost 98% African-American, except one position. And that position is a quarterback position. And I think, you know, the powers of people trying to kind of hold that back for a long time. And So I think that it's a very interesting cultural dynamic that's still at play.
Let's start with Russell Wilson. Mm-hmm. Here's a brilliant quarterback, an extremely talented quarterback, an athletic quarterback, and also somebody who's flexible in the pocket. But he doesn't talk a lot. He doesn't speak up. And in America, if you're the African-American who just keeps his mouth shut, you're perceived as, oh, he's smart and mature and he doesn't say anything. You're Cam Newton and you, like, raise your hand, you're suddenly the uppity N-word.
Mm. But I think even with Wilson, he's been to two Super Bowls and came within a bad throw of winning two. Even with that, people are still saying, well, you know, he really can't throw from the pocket, and constantly doubting him. This is about leadership. And it could be, you could go through almost any corporation, you know, where an African-American is in charge. And there's the same doubts, the same second guessing, whether it's Dean Baquet at the New York Times or Ken Chenault at American Express. You know, there's this thing about black men, Barack Obama in the White House. There's this thing about, you know, black people, black men in charge in positions of leadership, which brings up, I think, the worst of who we are as Americans. And I think it's just manifested in football with a quarterback position. So I think that it's just.
Well, I love the way your mind is racing, because I'm thinking of Colin Powell. A man in charge, a four-star general, but he's forced as Secretary of State to give the bogus rationale for going into Iraq. And it's essentially he gets punished for being the team player.
Yeah, and he's the fall guy. And I forgot about Colin Powell.
And he's the African-American fall guy.
Yeah. And so I mean, we could look at it just as a football issue, but it's not really a football issue. Football just happens to be what we're talking about. So I think that when we talk about Cam Newton, I think that what Newton's complaint is that I'm not being afforded the protection. Andrew Luck, they would not allow Andrew Luck to get beaten up like this. They would not allow Tom Brady, Philip Rivers to get beaten up like this. And I think that therein lies his complaint. It's not that this isn't a brutal game, it's not a brutal sport, but there's a certain protection that you have given these elite quarterbacks that you are not giving me.
When you mix racism in with money, maturity, youth, and the pressures of the NFL, I mean, are you looking at individuals who were African-American quarterbacks who had a certain amount of success? Randall Cunningham, you mentioned. Warren Moon's another we could talk about. Do they carry a burden of being a pioneer?
Yeah. I mean, listen, Warren Moon spent, he was an All-American at the Pac-10 at the University of Washington, had to go to Canada for, I may be getting this wrong, 7 or 8 years, had to go to Canada just to come back to get a shot. You know, Warren Moon went through therapy. Even when he came back and played, he went through therapy because of all the stuff that he had to take and hold in just to play a stupid position of quarterback. Cunningham preceded Moon, but even then there was sort of the burden of how he was playing, because he was so outside the norm with his running and that kind of. Later in his career, he sort of stayed in the pocket. Interestingly enough, a guy like Donovan McNabb took a lot of heat because his game was running and being mobile and getting out the pocket. But there was always, he wanted to prove to people, I could stay in the pocket. That's the sacred cow of quarterbacks in the National Football League is the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
That's the holy grail of the courageous white male standing in the pocket, taking the punishment and all that. But now you've got this breed of quarterbacks, and we've had different, from Michael Vick to Cunningham, Randall Cunningham, who basically are the greatest athletes on the team, and they run, they move around. So what we're talking about here is really of something that's been going on a long time.
Yeah, heavy burden. Yeah. William Roden, former columnist for the New York Times, now writer at large for ESPN's The Undefeated, author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
On this Monday, what if you could unzip that stiff suit of career, job, whatever it is that has you confined to a routine, and refit yourself? Just find a catalog of dreamy success stories and order up a new life. If you think I'm about to give out an 800 number and a never-failed diet plan, what I'm talking about is a far cry from supermarket checkout line self-help. Writer and lifestyle daredevil, I call him, Tim Ferriss, would be the first to say that taking control in a sustained, life-changing way is hard. It involves seeing opportunities away from popular crowds, cultivating the least obvious path, and then, after finding something promising, jumping obsessively in with both feet. Ferriss did this early on in his career. It's how he got from Princeton to sales in a data storage company, to his first startup, an internet business selling nutritional supplements. His book, The 4-Hour Work Week, which promised an end to the 9-to-5 slog, was a huge hit. Then The 4-Hour Body and The Tease of Becoming Superhuman. Ferriss's latest book is that catalog of dreamy success stories, Tools of Titans, the tactics, routines, and habits of billionaires, icons, and world-class performers. In it, he channels what's allowed billionaire investors and world-class athletes to make it to the top, where he says the titans live.
Who's a titan? A titan for me is someone who sets out to achieve something and achieves it after overcoming many obstacles, and ideally ends up, let's just say, in the top 1%. of performers in their given industry or trade or sport or whatever it might be. I try to focus on titans who have not arrived where they are based on primarily attributes. This is why perhaps maybe a terrible example because he has very, very good training, but I wouldn't go to Michael Phelps to learn how to swim because I cannot emulate or simulate his body type. It's perfectly suited for what he does. I would rather go to Phelps and say, who do you know who shouldn't be good at swimming, who is exceptional? Someone who doesn't fit the body type, someone who started late. I want to talk to that person.
Or just buy some weed from Phelps.
Or buy some weed from Phelps.
Yeah, I would be so intimidated to ask him about swimming.
I didn't learn to swim until I was in my 30s.
Really?
And I grew up on Long Island. How embarrassing is that?
Embarrassing? That's crazy.
Yeah,
why?
It's
crazy.
Why? I had a number of – I have a bad left lung. I was born premature and I was in the ICU for a long time. I still have respiratory issues. And I had a few near-drowning experiences in summer camp. And it just terrified me.
That'll do it.
So I stayed away from swimming completely.
And so what got you over the hump?
So it's funny you mentioned Phelps and weed.
That's a Titan experience there.
It's funny that you mentioned Phelps and weed because oftentimes when you find someone who's really good at spotting non-obvious things or the uncrowded bet, for instance, Chris Sacca is a friend of mine who went from relatively unknown to the cover of the Forbes Midas issue. So I watched his ascension. And he's really good at staring at the same thing everybody is seeing and just finding something different about it. And I met him at a barbecue. I told him about this problem I'd always had with swimming. And he said, I have the answer to your prayers, which is always setting expectations kind of high. But he introduced me to a method of swimming called total immersion. And it was created by
otherwise known as drowning.
Otherwise known as drowning. Well, it was created by an older gent named Terry Lachlan. And it completely rethinks how to teach swimming. And literally with a book, in the span of about 10 days, I went from not being able to do a lap to doing 30 to 40 laps in practice with zero stress.
Did you emulate the stare at the problem obsessively technique that you described a moment ago? Have you done that yourself, just stared at a problem? Because I got one for you,
Sure.
the political system.
So I
stare at that for a while.
I have stared at problems, but what I find, for me at least, more helpful now that I've gone through this exercise with a lot of different things is to ask seemingly absurd questions. That comes up a lot with people who are at the top of their game in different fields. So what if we did the opposite for 48 hours? Now, the political system, putting that aside for a moment, what if we did the opposite or tried the opposite for 48 hours? What would that look like? What if we had to, let's just say we have 100 hours allocated, if we had a gun against our heads and had to do it in 10 hours, what would we do? Understanding that there's no magical answer, but it will force you to fracture maybe the constraints that you've been assuming. So I tend to go into all of these different skills or areas with a set of questions like that that help me to hopefully see the things that are hidden or underappreciated, right? For instance, I'll give you one with swimming. If you go to take a swimming lesson, they start you with swimming. That's the problem. They should start with getting you comfortable dunking your head underwater and holding your breath and timing your breathing. And then they should only have you practice in water that you could stand up in, like 3 to 4 feet of water. That almost never happens. But then in retrospect, you're like, of course, that's so obvious. So the political system, I'm going to be pretty deep in my ignorance pool here. But I would say, for instance, learning a language is similar to political system in the sense that it's too all-encompassing. There are too many factors, too many facets. So I would try to thin slice that. So maybe we'd look at, I live in California, maybe we'd look at how can I influence San Francisco propositions.
Well, that's interesting because, I mean, you're coming up with a solution that a lot of people are talking about now, and that is go local.
Yeah.
Get local. Forget about this national business because it's just too absurd.
It's too absurd, and it's also too multivariate. There are just too many – there are too many issues, too many aspects, too many components. And also on the national stage – and this was actually something pointed out to me by Ezra Klein – people already have entrenched positions. And on the local level, yes, there will be people in favor of or against, but there are some very important issues and decisions that you can tackle that don't have, right from the get-go, an army against you and an entire population of people who are not going to change their position no matter how much evidence you supply them.
So when you decide to – I'll end on this – when you decide to spend all the work that it takes to write Tools of Titans, how do you not at the end of it just have such a feeling of total inadequacy? Because you're like none of them.
Well, this is the deep, dark secret that's not so dark. One of my main objectives with the book, first, I wrote it for myself. I never planned on publishing this one. This was just to consolidate my favorite.
You rejected it yourself first. yeah.
Tools so and tags for myself. But,
get that out of
but
the way.
What I was going to say is I wanted blueprints, but I also wanted to prove to myself and to people reading that all of these people we put on magazine covers, we put on pedestals, they're flawed creatures walking around with lots of weaknesses, fighting battles we know nothing about. And I wanted to make that super, super clear. So the reason that I actually feel the opposite of inadequate, I feel encouraged, is because all of these people, these titans, these icons, fill in the blank heroes, have their holes. They have their weaknesses. And the more I think we discuss that, the more we present it and tell those stories, which I try to elicit from them, the better we'll feel and the more progress we'll make.
It's great fun, this book, that's for sure. Tools of Titans. Tim Ferriss, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Tim Ferriss is the best-selling author of The 4-Hour Workweek and host of the Tim Ferriss Show podcast. His latest book, Tools of Titans, is out now. Boring Old Time magazine chose President-elect Donald Trump as Person of the Year for 2016. Duh. Who would you have picked?
My name is Ron Bremner from Glenridge, New Jersey. My person of the year is Kellyanne Conway, the Jersey girl who became the first woman to win as a campaign manager for president. You go, girl.
My name is Ashley Adams, and I'm calling from Salem in Oregon. I consulted my 15-year-old daughter, Sergio, with this question. We believe Michelle Obama is our person of the year. She has inspired in people a sense of decency and hope in the midst of all the hatred and the confusion. And we believe she's always been a wise and constant voice.
Kirkwood, Missouri, I think the person of the year are the Syrian refugees, especially the children, who have suffered horrors and are still not being helped. Who do you think was 2016 person of the year? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find The Takeaway on Facebook and leave a comment. Yeah, you can take that with you. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.